All right, here we go. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Welcome to CCNA Discovery 1 with Elise, minus Jackie this year. Yes, there's no Jay this year because she's off doing family things. So I'm on my own for the first time giving a course at CAVI. And whilst it's been absolutely wonderful working with Grace 18 months ago and Jackie over the last 12 months, I am now holding the mantle of in my own accord on this particular course. My name is Elise Lonsdale, and I am your instructor. Oh, there goes my redundant system. It's back up. My name is Elise Lonsdale, and I am going to guide you through the Discovery curriculum for the next 11 weeks. Unfortunately, we haven't had a too big a turnout today, but a small class is better than no class. So what we'll do is we'll have a little round robin, just a very quick 30 to 45 seconds of who you are, what you hope to get out of this course, and then we'll get straight into it, because this is the shorter of the two of the courses that are running at the moment. Shorter, but one of the harder ones, and I'm all glad you're here. So we'll go down. Usually we start at the instructors at the top, which is me, and then we'll go down the list alphabetical. So like I said, my name's Elise Lonsdale. I'll guide you through the Discovery course. I have a teaching background with blind people going all the way back to about 1992. I also have a corporate background working on many help desks and installing software, etc., as well as I've spent time in the community sector, and for the better part of for all of the last decade have been running one or two home businesses. So I am very, very interested in home and small businesses, which is why this course is actually one of the interesting ones for me, of course, because it is actually for home and small business. So it's Discovery 1 for home and small businesses. The next person to ask for a small brief introduction is the wonderful Kim Harborough.
Let's see, I'm Kim Harborough. I'm in Ontario, Canada, and I'm always interested in technology, so I decided to take this course because I could learn more. And I don't know quite what to say next. So that was probably about 15 seconds.
That'll do, because I'm sure you'll have plenty to say during the course. The next person is Marshall Scott.
Hi, I'm what they call a computer professional at work. I guess they got tired of trying to classify everybody, so they put us all in one big melange or stew. Been working with computers since the days of mainframes, and taking the course because I didn't feel ready to take exploration, and I'm still kind of working on ITE1. So,
excellent. And Marshall comes to us from the Draw scripting course last year that Jackie and I ran. And I'll move on now to Narissa Castle.
Hi, I live in Melbourne, Australia, and I'm basically self-taught. So I thought it was about time that I did a course to improve my computer knowledge. That's probably about it for me. It's just mainly that I want to improve my computer knowledge, and I've always had an interest in things like how IP addresses were written, how the internet works, that sort of thing. So I also thought maybe if I gained a bit more knowledge, I'd be able to fix my own computer and not have to call a technician in when anything went wrong. So anyway, got a lot to learn still, but I'll enjoy the course.
And I'm sure you will. Great to have another Melbourneite. Next lady is Pat Fletcher. I don't think you're actually on the schedule, but you're welcome to sit in on other classes. But hey, why don't you introduce yourself as well and join in?
Hi, thank you. I'm Pat Fletcher. I'm from Buffalo, New York. I decided to sit in on this class because I'm always trying to improve my skills. I've been using computers since the old 286, totally self-taught like the other lady, but sometimes time is the best teacher, and hands-on is the best teacher. So thank you.
Welcome along, Pat, and I hope you enjoy this course. I'll declare a quick interest in two of the students here. The relative size of the blind community means that we will often teach people whom we love and who we know from a long time ago, and that's Kim, of course, and Narissa. Narissa being more like an auntie of mine. I've known her since I was 4 years old. So there you go. What we do, it's like with Kylie last year, she was a friend. We taught her too, and we just simply say we don't show favoritism here at CAVI. We just make people work harder if we know them. Okay, before we get started, are there any... Yeah, that'll do. You're welcome. Okay, now, are there any questions? All right, silence is golden. Let's go. 1.1, personal computers and applications. And you might think, why, if we're in a networking course, are we going to spend a bit of time on personal computers and applications? Well, simple question is, there are questions about it in your test, and it is incumbent on me as your instructor to learn you. And that's about it. Cisco wants us to know. It's a little bit like an overview of ITE in this particular first couple of modules, and then the really grunt of the course starts in Module 3, as we said yesterday during the orientation. How and when computers are used. Computers play an increasingly important part in everyday life. Computers are used all over the world and for all sorts of applications. Businesses use computers. Manufacturing environments use computers. Of course, we have computers in the home. Government offices and non-profit organisations. Schools use computers for instruction and teaching. Hospitals can use computers, of course, for record keeping and other information. In addition to these types of computers, there's also many customized computers that are set up for specific purposes. Because computers and computer chips can be integrated into devices such as televisions, cash registers, and sound systems. They can even be found embedded in appliances such as stoves, refrigerators, automobiles or cars, aircraft. How many times have you ever been to a mechanic these days and only to find that, oh, well, we can't fix it so easy now because it's the computer, you know, whereas you get the old diehards who wanted to, who would just simply like the original cars before computers came along. Even hot water systems, as my neighbour found out last year, given we had a lightning strike here that took out a number of computers in our street, and took out a $2,000 controller for a hot water system, thus rendering my neighbour without hot water for several days until that was all sorted out. Computers, of course, consist of two main things, of course, and that's the hardware and software. Software being the computer programs and hardware being the physical things that you can touch and put in, unplug, pull out and blow up. The operating system, of course, is really a set of computer programs that manages the hardware of a computer. So the operating system, as you'll learn in IT, is really the interface between you and the hardware. It also helps you to manage memory and disk storage, so you can use your operating system to manage your files. Your operating system will also manage the other programs and what access to the RAM and other resources it has. An example of an operating system, of course, is Windows XP. Now, Windows Vista and Windows 7, there's a number of other operating systems around. Can anyone have a go at suggesting what other operating systems are? I know Marshall's going to come up with one, other than Windows.
Linux?
Yep, Linux is a good one.
Mac OS.
Yeah, well, they're just two popular other operating systems that are out there in the marketplace. Linux, of course, comes in a multitude of different distributions.
Lest you think I'm asleep, there's also Unix.
Yes, because Linux is a subset of Unix, isn't it? So, yeah, exactly. Local and network applications. Now, there's some test alerts coming up here, and the test alerts, if we remember to announce them, are where, for example, we know that there's things coming up in the test. So let's point those out if we can remember to do so. Usually if Kylie's here, she's good at doing this. She just texted me to say that she's off helping a student fiddle around with that wonderful entity we know as the Cisco website. Ugh, yuck. Sorry,
yes,
Cisco.
I had fun with that.
Yes, you've screwed up on that.
Thing.
Yeah, we make no apologies. We're no fans of the Cisco website because they've botched it. So there you go. All right, so we'll help them fix it if they want to come and do some consultancy with us. All right, so... applications, and this is the test alert that I was alluding to, basically come in two main types, or two general categories as it says here in the notes. Business/industry software, which is software designed for use by a specific industry or market. And examples of this is medical practice management tools, educational tools, CAD, which is computer-aided design, legal software, general use, that's rather curious. That's wrong. Okay, there's a mistake I've just found in the notes. How'd that get in there? But basically, all the specific, medical stuff that have specific programs are sort of specific to the actual industries. There's general use software, as what I used to call in the 1990s desktop software, and that would be consisting of your Word for Windows, your OpenOffice, your Excel spreadsheets, your programs you use for desktop publishing, web browsers, email clients, etc. They're the general use programs that you're going to find in the general environment used by home and small business. Integrated application packages, they're often known as, which is like MS Office or Office Suites in general anyway, because it's a number of different types of Office Suites. What else have we got? Yeah, graphics editing software and all that sort of stuff. Now, I would ask people to really read their notes. Whilst it's great to come to the lectures, we can only often paraphrase them, and Jackie and I do our best when we design these lecture notes or we design the lesson plans to put everything that we possibly can in them. But sometimes time constraints may require us to, sort of skip over a few things. So we do ask people to read the text notes. They are available in both Flash and, if you ask us nicely, in Word format. And I don't have any problems disseminating the Word versions of the curriculum. Are there any questions at this point?
What's the mistake in the notes so I don't learn it?
Oh, okay. It's got here one paragraph, and it could have just been a thing that Jackie and I accidentally copied and pasted. It has general applications in the specific applications. It had Office spreadsheet programs and that sort of stuff. So I just saw that as a bullet point when one of us must have formatted this up back in last June, July, August, or whatever we did it, because I'm just reading off the lesson plans that Jackie and I built for the last course, because it's exactly the same.
So, would it be wrong in my notes?
Possibly not,
Or just your
because
class notes?
just my class notes. Jackie and I used to design a lesson plan every week, and we used to sit up on a Sunday morning and do it. And it's highly possible someone's copied and pasted an extra bullet point somewhere. So I don't know whether it's actually in the class notes. If it is, it's wrong. Your own common sense is going to tell you anyway. If whilst desktop applications are found in offices like doctors and lawyers' offices and hospitals and stuff, because they too want to do spreadsheeting and word processing and things. The specific applications that may be written for libraries or may be written that you'll find in a doctor's surgery that look after patient records and that sort of stuff. I know somebody who was one of my clients until he passed away recently who made a specific application for that sort of genre.
Oh, I see. They're talking about specific to a particular thing, like a doctor's business might actually make up a program that will show their whatever they want to show, like as opposed to a general
Well, yeah, patient
application
records.
that's like Office or something. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, sure, you could use MS Access or Excel to keep, a spreadsheet or something of patient records, but usually you find doctors will have their own programs. Like usually they're industry based. I couldn't really mention one offhand. Jackie would know. There's industry based that get around the industries, that get around the medical profession, and get around the. Well, the one I was thinking of was a program called Snapshot, which was a program that could be used either for hospital record keeping or local government, like councils, and I guess you could say county level in the United States for people keeping records and stuff of maybe, I don't know, ratepayers or something. I don't know. Unfortunately, the gentleman who wrote it passed away recently, and that was a sad loss for my business as well as for his family. So there you go.
While we're on the subject of notes, I assume the class notes are the ones in Discovery 1 section on the QCAT site.
They are, and I don't know whether Kerry's got those up there in doc or RTF format, but I've got them here if you want to have them, Marshall. I can send them across to you. I don't mind giving them out. I'm not sure whether they're up on the QCAT server or not. They had this push onto the Flash, let's all go use Flash and we shouldn't be handing out the class notes because it's violating copyright. But hey, Flash is just tricky to study from, and that's my belief on it all. And I'm sorry, but I'm more than happy to hand out the text-based version of the notes that can be read on any device capable of reading text.
Yeah, if you would. I want to make sure I did find them way down in the down with I did find some down in the lab section, which is where the questions are the quizzes and worksheets are as well.
Yeah, there is a curriculum. I don't know that he's got them up there. I'm pretty sure he hasn't. But he may have changed his, Kerry may have changed his mind. I don't know. I don't really get on the QCAT server as much as I probably should because there's so much else to do. And I've got a reasonably good enough mirror of it here at home anyway on Endeavour.
Okay.
But I'll send it to you, and that goes for anyone listening in listener lands as well. All right, now, there are also network applications, actually, which are programs that are designed to run over a network. Now, most of the programs we've talked about up to date are programs that are running local, which means they're stored on your hard drive, they get loaded into RAM, and they run, and you shut them down, or you curse at it if it won't shut down, and you get on with your life. There are other programs that are designed to be run across a network. Okay, let me see what I've got here in the notes. There are usually two components to a network application, and they are, and a good example of this is email, of course. Usually you have a network component on the server and a client, or a mail client, for example, or a chat client, or something running on a local workstation. Okay, and that's probably a good example. Any questions at this point? All right, silence is golden. Let's go. And it was the tremolos on this side of the pond, wasn't it, Nerissa?
Yep, it certainly was.
Yeah, we decided we had that discussion last year over dinner, didn't we? All right. There are many different types of computers, and this is also in the test. We have mainframes, which I think Marshall could probably tell us more about. We have servers, desktop computers, workstation computers, laptops, and handheld and portable devices. And for people interested in IT, there's a lot of that talked about in IT Chapter 6. Each of these computers has been designed with a particular purpose in mind. Of course, the most common type. What do you think in home, the context of home and small businesses, the most common types of computers might be? I'll just throw it open to the group.
Desktops and laptops.
Yep, any others?
Small portable devices.
Yep, and one more. Two more if you really want, but one will do.
Well, they do count mobile phones as computers, don't they? The ones that, you know, will
Yep.
download MP3s and all that
Yeah,
sort
all
of
the
thing.
other portable devices, yeah, yep, all well, smartphones and things, yeah, they come under the category of other portable devices. I'm looking for something else.
Servers.
Well done. I was just about to say to Nerissa and Kim, who know my place, what have I got sitting over here next to me other than my workstation? The servers, exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of offices these days who are running their own internal servers. You know, for, you know, if you've got three, four, five, six, seven, eight workstations in a home, in a small office, they'll put in something like Microsoft Small Business Server, or if they do it with Linux, that's a, in my opinion, a better option. But anyway, yeah, they'll put in a server, or I think Apple has one now, the X server and stuff. So yeah, because they want to keep their records in a central place, and they would probably offer self and use it for email and their own in-house intranet, etc.
Actually,
Workstations actually, go ahead.
Apple did away with it, the X serve. It died on Tuesday, officially.
Oh, really? Really? Is that right?
Yeah,
I never
now
knew
they
that.
the only server they'd sell you is a non-rack mountable beast. So there's a quite a furor in the Mac community that there are no more X serves.
Well, how about that? I know one person who shall remain nameless, but who resides in Perth will love that. Oh, boy. Okay, fair enough. Well, there you go, a bit of breaking news. Okay, let's have a look at some of these categories of computers. Servers, desktops, and workstations. Here we go. Servers. Servers are usually high-performance computers used in businesses and other organizations. They can serve many end users and clients. Server hardware is optimized for quick response. And that is because it has to handle many, many network requests. You know, it can be, say, for example, serving out a file across the network, either local or remote, while at the same time having to deliver email to a client, or even running a web page, a small website for people. So the servers can be up to many things at any one time. My friend's Kim in particular at the moment's getting on my Endeavour server, putting files up there or getting stuff off it, while at the same time there could be a myriad of people looking at the Cisco Vision website, for example. And I'm looking at my email. So it's up to all sorts of things at any one point. These devices, these servers must have an adequate amount of RAM or random access memory. And multiple high-capacity disk drives that provide very fast information retrieval. Well, mine doesn't fall into that category, but suffice it to say, if it was a bigger business, it would need to. So yeah, I'd need to make sure that the hard drives were fast, there was lots of RAM on it, and some servers also have redundant components. And it just reiterates what I said here, the services that a server provides have to be provided at all times. You know, Jackie was telling me this morning, she was up on my server the other night when she knew I was asleep, getting stuff off it because, well, actually, downloading last year's drill scripting course. There you go. But she, chose a time when she knew I wasn't probably likely to be up. But I didn't want to mind it anyway. Servers will often have a lot of redundant parts, particularly in the corporate environment, so that if there's anything that fails, like a set of hard drives set up in a RAID configuration, one fails, there's another one that can come back in quickly. The server administrator will often... Yep, go ahead.
Sorry, are they basically, like the redundant parts, are they basically like backup parts, so that if one fails, another one will take over?
Yep, that's exactly what happens in a RAID environment. That's exactly what happens. You'll actually have multiple hard drives, each with the same information on them. And it's continuously, keeping it all synchronized. A network administrator may also make a manual backup. Sometimes these are automatic, sometimes these are manual. Mine are manual because I haven't gotten around to rewriting the script since I took Challenger out and replaced it with Endeavour, which is not good. And also Craig and I were going to do some scripting that made it a bit more automated and usual thing, never got around to it. But there are people out there who have, and there are plenty of programs out there that will also do it for you. Servers should also be kept in secure areas, which means you'll find that in a lot of small to medium and even large environments, they've got a server room, generally often locked, and if they've got too many servers in them, they're actually cooled, because the amount of machines running in there can cause you a bit of heat buildup. Those environments, well, of course, it's obviously prudent to keep your server safe because you don't want anyone coming in tampering with it. Okay, are there any questions at this point? Okay, servers can come in three different types of design according to these notes, which is true. The good old standard tower, which is looking really makes it look like your, desktop machine that you've got under your desk. A rack-mounted server, which is a server that's actually mounted in a rack. And a blade design, and let's look at some of these. So we'll look at these. It also says here a server can be typically used as a storage retrieval device, so it may not necessarily have a monitoring keyboard connected to it. At the moment, there's no monitor on my server because I can access it via a terminal program. I can physically plug the monitor in at any time, it's just that it isn't there. Usually you see these servers in many offices and stuff that may share a monitor with another server or may share a monitor and keyboard with another server or another computer because it's not really necessary to have a monitor plugged in all the time. Particularly with most servers these days allows for some type of remote admin. It says here they may share a monitor and keyboard with other devices. Common services, of course, I think this is getting a bit repetitive here, is file storage, email storage, web pages, print sharing, and others. Okay, that's some of the things we find on a server. Okay, now with the blade design, we talked about the rack-mounted server being screwed into a rack. We talked about the desktop server looking like your desktop server. I just went out on the internet yesterday and just got the exact definition of a blade server, and it is Basically, it says here that a blade server combines the maximum combination of computing power and scalability, which means scalability simply means we can, you know, put more stuff on it. It's often a stripped-down server with a modular design, optimized to minimize the physical space around it and optimize the usage of energy. It often has a chassis housing, multiple thin circuit boards known as server blades. Sometimes it says here each blade is a server in its own right. The rack-mounted server is pretty much exactly what it sounds like. It's a device ideal for saving floor space when that is when that's at a premium, and it's mounted on an equipment rack. So it's basically, they're not very big in design, they're quite small. Now, it talks here about standalone servers. A standalone server, which is really what mine is appropriate for small businesses and does provide for flexibility. You can choose some of the internal components, like my server, for example, doesn't come with the same hard drive it had in it when it came out of the box, for example. Are there any questions?
What exactly do they mean by a standalone server, that it doesn't connect to other servers? I mean, it would have to connect to...
Yeah, I don't like that term, because it connects to, you know, obviously has to connect to something, doesn't it? It has to connect to the internet, or it has to connect to some workstations. I guess in some ways mine could be conceived as standalone because there's no other server in the house. So, yes, it's connected to two workstations at the moment, and it is also connected via Ethernet to the router, and if I wanted to, I could make a connection between the VoIP box and the server to do some interesting things. But, yeah, it's not really connected to another server at the moment, so I guess that's where they're getting that term from. I don't remember it being talked about in the exam, though, but, again, please read your class notes.
So I did read them, and basically, I didn't completely follow what it was.
Basically, as you get bigger and bigger, you have to have more servers, because one server can't handle... things for like 1,000 workstations, so they put in multiple servers and then handle requests to different servers, so you don't tie up one server handling, you know, 1,000 people.
Yeah, when I worked at Premier and Cabinet in Spring Street, they had a big server room, and there were servers running Lotus Notes, a couple of those, I think. Another one managing the email, although Lotus Notes actually managed the email, but there could have been another email server. There were other servers there managing, you know, just documents, really, and the storage of other information and that sort of stuff. But, yeah, you'll find that. I've worked in many different places, that, as I talked about, server rooms. So you've got some of them dedicated to doing things like email, some of them dedicated to doing things like serving out of web pages, running databases even, just some of them are sitting there doing database stuff. So sometimes when you hit a web page on a server, for example, although it's the ideal configuration to have your SQL database on the same server, I was once working with a host that actually had their SQL, MySQL databases and MS SQL databases running off another server. So of course that created all sorts of problems with the IP addressing between the two of them, but as far as the person looking at any of the websites that needed those databases, they probably just thought they were coming off one server.
They also use what they call compute servers for like big problems like weather maps and simulating nuclear explosions, other big things where they don't use any of the resources on the computer except the processing capacity.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll just go and see what's happening in the other channel for a sec. I've just moved Brian in and also moved the redundant system back in as well because it was sitting up there on the top of the tree. Good morning, Brian. It's Elise Lonsdale. I've just moved you in for the discovery. We're just talking about different types of hardware and computing. I was just wondering if you'd like to just quickly introduce yourself for about 30 seconds, Brian.
Sorry about that. My dogs were barking. I'm just... thought I'd pop through. I'm actually a brand new student, started last night, so I just thought I'd pop through and see what was going on.
Oh, welcome. Which course are you doing with us, Brian?
ITE C2, actually.
Oh, you're from Grace's class. Oh, welcome aboard. This is a little bit like a rush through IT because it's part of the networking course. Okay, desktop computers can have many different connection types. Let's see, video options. and a wide array of supported peripherals. Desktops are commonly used to run applications such as word processors, spreadsheets, and networked applications such as email and web browsing. The workstation is another much more powerful device. Generally, a workstation is a high-powered business computer that's designed for specialized high-end applications such as computer-aided design, engineering programs, and also 3D graphics design, video animation, and virtual reality simulation, and probably for Marshall simulating nuclear explosions. They can also be used for user management. Running for telecommunications equipment and medical equipment as well. Workstations typically have the following attributes: multiple CPUs, large amounts of memory, multiple high-capacity disk drives that are very fast, very powerful graphics capabilities, and a large monitor, or often multiple monitors. Are there any questions? The above-mentioned computers were... Sorry, did somebody want to mic up?
I was going to ask, when you were talking about multiple processors, are you referring to, like, the Intel multiple processors, like the quads?
Yes. In actual fact, no, not so much the quad cores, multiple processors in general. So, but I might actually have to look that one up. I haven't played with a workstation for a while. In addition to the stationary computers, because these are all stationary computers, you've got laptops and portable devices. Yeah, no, I think they actually mean actually multiple physical processors. Because in my desktop, I've got a quad-core processor, which, as you say, your Intel's. Okay, with our portable devices, they all vary in size, and they include laptops and notebook PCs, and netbooks too now, with the triple E's and the little HP's and those things that are getting around. That includes a tablet PC, pocket PCs, a personal digital assistant, which is a PDA, gaming devices, and cellular telephones. It's pretty obvious. It says laptop computers provide computing power for the mobile computing workforce, in other people in businesses. They are obviously devices that have slower CPUs, they often have less RAM, and they have small screens with limited capabilities. They also may have a small keyboard, and this can be often an interesting factor. I've seen many vision impaired folk who like to look at these laptops in shops or netbooks in shops before they make their purchase, to make sure that they actually like the keyboard, because your proprioception and your spatial ability is very important on a keyboard, and to have a small keyboard can often be confusing, because sometimes there's no gaps between the function keys, etc. The key advantage of these devices, of course, is that information can be available immediately anywhere, as long as you've got a connection, I guess, to the internet. They store address books for telephone numbers, and then you can sort of tell a whole bunch of war stories when you come and synchronise that address book with your desktop computer back at home, how you got all the duplicate entries. Yuck. You've got usually the ability to run a web browser and an email client, etc. Okay, they're talking about multifunction devices here, like PDA, which is a personal digital assistant, cell phones, digital cameras, and music players. So, yeah, okay, everyone go out and buy an iPhone. There you go. It's got everything on it, hasn't it? While it's got limited processing, it can provide network connectivity to the internet. Now, we have a paragraph here on laptops, and I'm really sure I don't have to go into too much of this detail. Laptops have got limited RAM, and they usually use less of a processor, because they got to worry about heat buildup and all that sort of stuff. So you'll find that traditionally laptops these days, and certainly the netbooks, aren't as powerful. The higher the processing power, the more RAM it's going to use. But they'll have a built-in mouse like a trackpad, and been the bane of many vision impaired users. Laptops can be plugged into a docking station or port replicator to utilise a larger monitor and mouse. Despite all of this, often laptops have a limited number of options, including video types. We were only looking at some netbooks the other day, Kim and I, and we were worried about, even though we could plug it into a bigger monitor, the graphics array would only allow it to a certain type of resolution. So you do need to give some thought when you're purchasing a laptop. What are you going to do with it? If you're just going to be out and about and never hook it up to anything, you don't really care and you're happy with the lower resolution, that sort of stuff, that's fine. So it's really what suits you. A tablet PC, are there any questions so far? No, good, right, I've put you all to sleep. Wonderful, I'll just keep talking to myself for the next hour and a half. All right.
We're still here.
We're still.
Tablet PCs. This is typically a wireless device with a stylus type pen. And again, Kim, Vicky and I were talking about this yesterday. A pen that you can use to sketch on or write. I've never really used one. I've seen them around. You can write on an LCD screen and, you know, basically it can interpret handwriting and stuff.
Handy.
Yeah. Well, even these
they're really, really gadgets. Handy for those college students because most of them will convert what you've written over into Word documents for you. They're really handy for college students. I own two of them.
Oh, very good. They have... Tablet PCs can also have comparable software to that of desktops. Laptops and desktops. They usually have a convertible screen that functions like a laptop, folded down over the integrated keyboard. A tablet PC may also run a special OS such as Microsoft Windows Tablet Edition. So there you go. Pocket PCs. A pocket PC is a scaled-down version of laptop with a less powerful CPU, less RAM, and no hard disk. Most pocket PCs do have a small QWERTY keyboard. They come with a coloured screen with fairly good resolution. They do use memory cards to store user documents and photographs and run a special OS like Microsoft Mobile, for example. Typically the size of a candy bar and weigh less than 7 ounces. Okay, they can have the following features though. PowerPoint Viewer and Mobile Excel, cellular phone capability, email, and wireless networking. With their memory storage, they use a persistent storage. They have a touch screen, some type of camera. The megapixels have been taken out, but they'll have some sort of camera on them. They could even make small home movies. That can be used as a voice recorder for taking notes, and high-speed internet capability. Wow. And we've got the famous PDAs, our personal digital assistants. A PDA, our personal digital assistant, can be known as a handheld alarm, a palm top. Now, I'm going to skip through some of these because I'm sure we've all been around and we've probably all been to business seminars and that sort of stuff, and you spend more time watching the guys get their PDAs out basically to show you how good they are and to look good because they're using it. Am I cynical? Yeah. Okay. Some of these pocket PCs, the devices between PDA, the terminology between PDAs, etc., are blurred. The line's becoming quite blurry, especially in the advent of the Apple iPad and iPhone, etc. You can sort of use one for the cellular network, etc. So it's really the converging of technologies. Okay. Gaming devices. I know nothing about gaming devices. I haven't probably played with one since the 1980s. There you go. Portable gaming device is a small dedicated computer dedicated to running computer games, has a reasonably good quality display, and etc. And I was going to introduce Kylie, who's run away. Okay, do we have another... And John's left the server too. Maybe they were just practicing. They've come onto the server and they've heard my voice and they've gone, nah, go away. Now I'm sure Kylie's out there doing a wonderful job getting people up on the system and probably showing them how to navigate around Ventrilo. Okay. Cellular phones. Well, we all know what one of those are. They're the things you can use to talk to your friends while at the same time causing cancer of the wallet. They're always expensive to run. They usually come... in many cases, often replacing regular landline phones. I suppose you have to be in a reasonable plan for that to happen, but I've seen it happen. They're becoming increasingly powerful, but most of them do not have a keyboard, and they often lack a large enough screen to use as you would a large computer. A cell phone can have some advanced features, basically, like a PDA. They can have calendars built into them, mine does, contact information or an address book, memory card storage, digital camera, camcorder. They often have MP3 players. They will allow you to play games. They will have some of them now got Wi-Fi on them, email, and some type of internet access. Yeah, okay. Okay, are there any questions at this point? Okay, I feel that we're coming into the more juicier parts now. The binary representation of data. Okay, guys, in a computer, information is stored in binary, or bits, really. The term bit is an abbreviation of binary digit and represents the smallest piece of data that you can get. Okay, a bit, now we're going to do more of this as we get into the IP addressing part of this course. A bit can only have two values. Can anyone suggest to me what those two values might be?
0 and 1.
Well done, Narissa. For example, a light switch can only be in two states as well, on and off, or off and on. And these states will correspond to 1 and 0. Computers use binary codes to represent numbers and letters. A commonly used code is the American Standard Code for Information Interchange, or what's known as ASCII, A-S-C-I-I, American Standard Code for Information Interchange. Okay, in ASCII, characters can be represented as a string of bits. For example, A may be represented, and we don't expect you to remember this, A may be represented by 01000001. 9 might be represented, for example, as 00111001, etc. Each group of 8 bits is known as a byte. Okay, so we're going to start talking about bits and bytes as the course continues. Okay, this information can represent any type of computer data, like graphics, photos, voice, video, and music. It's really only binary. So at the moment, now, is everyone happy with this so far?
Yep.
Okay, well, a bit is the most... is the smallest unit of data, but the most commonly... the smallest unit of measure is really the byte. So we often talk here, and this gets a bit hard to sort of read word for word, but basically what it's saying is that we usually talk about stuff in bytes. Okay, 8 bits to a byte. Now, when we're referring to storage space, we use the terms bytes, usually denoted with a capital B. Now, just be careful when we go through the exams for the screen reader users. Look for the lowercase and uppercase Bs, Ks, Ms, Gs, and Ts, which we're about to come to. We often talk about kilobytes, which is represented by a capital K and a capital B, kilobytes. Megabytes is represented by a capital M and a capital B. And gigabytes is represented by a capital G, a capital B. Terabytes, which is represented by a capital T and a capital B. 1 kilobyte is a little more than 1,000 bytes. Okay, and we'll talk about that soon. Just remember, 1 kilobyte is a little more than 1,000 bytes. It's actually 1,024. Bytes. Now, a megabyte represents more than 1 million bytes. A gigabyte is 1 billion over 1 billion bytes. Now, the exact number is gained by taking 2 to the power of, and this is where it gets hard for me to correlate it to, by taking 2 to the power of the number. And I'm going to get you individually, I'll get you to go through your notes here. So really, KB is equal to 2 to the power of 10, or 2 to the power of 20, etc. In general, and we'll come to more of this sort of stuff later and maybe get Jackie on because she's better at maths than I am. When something is represented digitally, the greater amount of detail will cause you to have the greater amount of bits to represent it. Now, a good example of this, and I think Narissa will see this, well, actually, no, we can do it in two ways, is a photo of a digital camera. It's going to be bigger in file size if it's got more definition, if it's clearer. Would you agree with that, Narissa?
Yes, I don't know much about digital cameras, but yes.
And would you agree with the fact that the better the encoded a file is, it's going to be bigger?
Definitely.
So we have more information in that file to cause the better definition picture, or to cause the easier, the better listening experience on an MP3 or a WAV file. It says here in the notes that a high definition picture is 2 megabytes or more. Yeah, well, you should see what comes off my camera half the time. Okay. Now. Okay, devices used to store all this junk is RAM, of course, hard disk space, CDs, DVDs, and MP3 players. Now, speed and resolution. Let's have a look at this next bit. Are there any questions so far while I just look a quick look ahead? All right, speed, resolution, and frequency. One of the advantages of digital information is that it can be transmitted over long distances without the quality becoming degraded. Often a modem is used to convert the binary information into a form suitable for transmission over the media, or over the medium actually. Commonly used. That's okay. Somebody's chatting. Okay. Commonly used media are cables that use pulses of electricity, fiber optics that use pulses of light usually transmitted through plastic or glass. Wireless, which uses pulses of low energy radio waves. Now, there are two measures for the size of a file. A bit, or which is represented by a lowercase b, and bytes, which is represented by a capital B. So bits and bytes. Just think a little bit is for the little letter and the big letter is for a byte. Communications engineers think in terms of transferring bits, and users generally think in terms of file sizes. And this is where I'm going to get you to read your notes. We often talk about kilobytes, megabytes, etc. when we're talking about the amount of stuff we can get off the internet. The data rate of your internet connection can determine the amount of time taken to transfer a file. Data transfer rates are often measured in thousands of bits per second, or kbps. That is, most engineers round the data down. Now, when they round the information down, they're talking about the kbps. They're often talking about the rounded down version of it. When remember how I said it's just over one meg is just over 1,000 kilobytes. Sorry. Okay. Now, if you see kbps with a capital K, it's usually used to denote the transfer of 1,024 bits, 1024, in 1 second. So let's say, for example, we want to transmit 1024 bits, or one kilobit, we're talking about over the time frame of a second. Okay, what else can we do? I'm going to skip a bit. Okay, what else? So any questions at the moment?
Nope.
Can we put you all to sleep? Okay, there's little basic things in the test about that sort of stuff, but they're not too hard. Okay. Peripherals.
So when can we take the test? Like, are the tests already available?
I'll put the test up later today if you feel ready to tape them. We generally do. We generally put them up over the... we generally put them up after a class, yeah. Generally do.
So I think it's a good idea to do it when you're fresh.
Yeah, well, if you want to do it today, by all means, you've got a week to do it. Although, I'll always re-enable them anyway. Because as always, life gets in the way and we don't have the, you know, some people can't get to them in a week. And sometimes people also like a little extra time to study. There's a formula here in the notes, which is, I'm going to find it difficult to change into words. It's about how to calculate the time a file takes to download over a given given space, and we'll come and do more on that. Computer components and peripherals. There are many types of computers, as we've discussed, and I'm just cognizant of the time here. Yep, we're halfway through. Okay, let me see. What makes one computer better than another? The requirements of a machine dedicated to word processing are very different from that required for somebody who wants to do high-end graphics or play games. Now, many manufacturers mass-produce computer equipment and sell these through direct marketing or, you know, chain stores, etc. There are a number of small vendors who will custom build a computer for you and assemble it. And this is going to be an interesting point coming up very soon. So we've got our mass-produced computers like our Dells, our Compaqs, HPs, etc. that come out of the factory and get sold through the shops. And we have your little man down the road who will build your computer, or you can build your own computer of your own, your own specifications. There are advantages and disadvantages for both. Okay, a pre-assembled computer. Let's have a look at the pre-assembled one versus the one that you get built with your own specs. Now, I know Narissa has a technician who comes in and has often built them here and in a computer. We've built the ones here, and they've all got, you know, specific components. Pre-assembled computer. Advantages. There are a lower cost. They're adequate to perform... most applications. There's no waiting time to get it built for you, and they're typically used by less knowledgeable consumers. Now, the first point, lower cost. Okay, 10, 15 years ago, you got a pre-built computer, you would be paying generally a lot of money for a piece of junk. These days, the pre-assembled computers are actually low cost. It is a got-you in the exam, so people who have been around a while are going to get that question wrong unless they think about what's going to happen, well, what's really happened over the last 5 or 10 years, and that is your pre-assembled computers coming out of places like Newegg, you know, Best Buy, etc., or here in Australia, Harvey Norman, etc., Compaqs, Dells, etc., are often cheaper. They're not as well... The specs on them aren't as good, and they can be often a bit trickier to upgrade and have weird drivers, etc., but they are now cheaper than often the custom-built ones, which the computer I'm talking to you on now is a custom-built computer, whereas, you know, several years ago when I got started, it was always far cheaper and far better to get a custom-built computer if you're trying to save money. So the paradigm has shifted in the other direction there. So they're the advantages. They're adequate. They're lesser cost, and there's no waiting time to get your pre-built computer. You can just go down the shop and buy one. The disadvantages, of course, is that they often lack the performance that can be attained by a custom-built computer. There's no way you do half the stunts that I can do on this machine on a pre-built one. Custom-built computers are the alternative, of course, which have some advantages and disadvantages also. The end user can specify exact components. I did. When I had my lightning strike, I went to Dennis and I said, I would like this particular type of motherboard, please. Can you do it? And he said, yes. I gave him two hard drives, and which I actually put in the machine myself and just got him to fit the motherboard because I've got lazy. And that's about it. And, yeah, pretty much. Oh, and we reused the graphics card. That was also... reasonably good graphics card. These custom-built machines will generally support things like graphics gaming, server applications, so they're much better in performance. Okay, the disadvantage of these machines is that they're generally a little bit more expensive, quite a bit more expensive now, whereas, as I said to you before, originally they were always the cheaper option. Now they can be much more expensive. And there's a longer waiting period for assembly, so you might say to your technician, I'd like this, this and this, and it might take them a couple of days to build it for you. You can also purchase the components yourself and build it yourself, like we did once on a Sunday afternoon. Regardless of your decision as to which one you'll purchase, the final product, whether it be a custom-built computer or a pre-assembled, mass-produced one, really has to match the user's requirements. So some of the items can that you must consider when purchasing a computer, let's throw open to the whole channel. What should we consider when we purchase a computer?
Well, how much RAM you want to get?
Yep, it's one of the aspects.
Processor speed.
Processor speed, yep.
Number of disks.
Hard drives, yep. You may want one or more hard drive, or you may want a particular capacity hard drive.
Connectivity options.
Connectivity options is good, yep. Do we want Wi-Fi or do we want Ethernet or both? Did anyone mention motherboard?
We always miss the most obvious thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Up until recently, they had bus speeds you had to consider. Is the bus speed going to be compatible with your RAM and your processor and that sort of stuff? So you definitely need the main board.
Power source, CPU and RAM. I just did
that. Yeah, great one. Thanks
power source.
Power supply's good. Yeah, because in ITE, one of your first exercises will be to go and research computer components and go and get a, you know, build up a theoretical computer. And one of the things you have to consider is what type of power supply you want in it. So it's a great idea. Now, everybody knows the motherboard is a circuit board that is really the main board of the computer. That's where the processor sits, which is typically the largest component on the motherboard. Some people can feel the fan and all that sort of stuff that sits above it. The CPU and RAM attached to it, and the expansion cards attached to it. The motherboard basically moves data between the various connections and system components. A motherboard can also contain connector slots for video and sound. Many motherboards, including this one, comes with sound already on it, integrated sound and integrated graphics, and pretty much all of them now come with an integrated network card. I've actually put in my own separate network card. In actual fact, this high-end motherboard actually doesn't come with a graphics card because if you're going to buy this type of motherboard, you're buying the thing for performance, so they haven't bothered putting the Intel graphics on it, but you might hear integrated sound, video and network. So if you've got one of those motherboards and you elect to put in a separate sound card, like a lot of musicians do, for example, you'll either plug in the card and or disable the onboard audio, or sometimes, like on my old machine Firebolt, you could run them together. I had two sound cards, one built into the motherboard and a sound blaster that was plugged in. Okay. Okay, obviously upgrade and etc. has to be taken into consideration. If you've got an integrated motherboard and you want to get better sound, you've got to plug in a sound card. You can't really remove the sound card that's on it. But if you already have a sound card and you want to get a better one, you can change it. Okay, when selecting a motherboard, it must support the selected CPU type and speed, and it must support the amount of system RAM and have the sufficient slots to select to support all your different cards. The CPU or processor is the nerve center of the whole thing and is the biggest component that processes all of the data in the machine. One of the decisions that you should make Marshall put it before, you have to consider the CPU. It really should be the first decision you make. What do you want as your CPU? And then you go out from there. Okay, the important factors are the processor speed and bus. Now, Some of the newer higher-end motherboards do actually not have a front-end bus, believe it or not. The processor speed is measured in cycles per second. And it's generally measured in megahertz or gigahertz per second. It's capital N, capital H, little z, and capital G, capital H, and little z. Obviously, the higher the speed, the faster the performance. Now, faster processors consume more power and generate more heat than their slower counterparts. For this reason, the mobile devices such as laptops generally have slower processors. The bus speed is important if you still have a bus on your computer. The CPU transfers data. CPUs transfer various types of data, and it has to have a pathway or a bus to do that. So the pathway for this movement is called a bus, and the better the bus, the better the performance of the machine. So you don't want to get a processor that will simply choke and not run on a particular motherboard's bus. Again, ITE goes through a lot of this. When selecting a CPU, keep in mind that applications continuously evolve. So your program that you loved in the 90s might, for example, still be around, but be a hell of a lot more bloated and slower in the year 2010 or 2011. So you definitely need a lot more grunt to run it. Here comes the rain. Okay, high resolution graphics is something you have to take into account. The CPU is usually mounted through a socket on the motherboard, and I'm going to skip some of this because, again, it's in your notes. Adapter cards, of course, we all have seen these around. They add functionality to your computer system and have to be plugged into a connector or slot on the motherboard. Many motherboards are designed to accommodate adapter cards, and they come in, as we've already discussed, video cards, sound cards, network interface cards, modems, and controller cards. Generally, these days, you don't see so many controller cards. The video card will accept data and turn it into a format that it can be displayed on a monitor. And these cards are often one of the most powerful cards because they contain large amounts of RAM and often they're in their own processor. They need this to manipulate video, so it's better to actually dedicate some of those resources to what happens on the card rather than using up the machine's resources, because this sort of stuff can be pretty juicy. A video card is based on speed, resolution, and price. Artists and gamers can require better graphics cards or video cards, and the video cards match the capabilities of all connected monitors. For example, if you've got a really old monitor, you might find it's either not going to work at all or not look too pretty if you connect it up to a really high-end graphics card. A sound card accepts digital information, converts it into sound. Sound or signals that can be, sent to a speaker. A high-end sound card these days can produce a sound that is comparable to some of the best stereos around now. So that will really get the sound files upset, the audio files upset, I guess. You've also got network interface cards, which allow you to have connectivity between your machine and a network. And they can be wireless or they can be Ethernet. The standard that we're mainly going to talk about in this course, or is the standard really, or it's become the de facto standard, is the standard known as Ethernet. Modems, they can come either as peripheral devices or also as cards. A modem will allow modulation and demodulation of a signal so that you can connect your computer to the public switched telephone network or PSTN network. Most of us these days are using broadband modems of some description anyway. DSL and cable are included in the broadband section. Controller cards. While most motherboards have a number of interfaces allowing connection, such as printers, connection of printers, mice, etc., you still often have controller cards for specialized devices such as external hard disk drive. Well, yeah, usually that's integrated into the motherboard. Now I've had to install a controller card for years. Quick question. Any questions out there before we move on to storage devices, which will be 1.4.4? All right, storage devices. Essentially, well, as we know, when the power is lost, anything in RAM is gone, so we need to put our information on things like hard drives, and we do. A storage device, like a hard drive, is known as non-volatile storage. This includes magnetic storage devices such as hard drives, optical storage devices, which are CD-ROMs, CDs and DVD devices, and static memory, which are your flash drives and memory sticks. Okay, magnetic storage is the most common found in computers, which is your hard drives, floppy drives, and tape drives. A hard disk is also the main storage medium found in most common computers. Really, and that includes laptops, desktops, and servers. These can be internal, but also can come in the form of removable hard drives. An external hard drive can be connected through USB, and many of us these days have those. As the storage capacity of the hard drive increases, so does the price. Yes, you have to think about the price. Floppy drives are mainly becoming redundant. You do see them occasionally around. They hold 1.44 megabytes of information. They've been really replaced these days by static memory, such as, you know, thumb drives, flash drives, etc., that you just shove in the USB. Tape drives are generally used for backing up, archival, and disaster recovery. So they're not, a tape drive is obviously something we really can't use for, you know, accessing data quickly. It's just, you know, used for storage of data for disaster recovery. It can take up to many gigabytes of information. A tape drive is typically encountered only in the server environment, so you don't really see home environments using them now. And it's been a little while since I've been in the corporate environment, so who knows what they're up to, but they're probably still using them. Optical drives are your CDs and DVDs. Basically, DVDs and CDs come in three different formats. They are read-only, or CD, or DVD-Rs, write once, sorry, CDs or CDs, CDs or DVDs, sorry, write once, which is your CDR or DVDR, and write many, which is your CD-RWs and DVD-RWs. The prices of these devices continue to fall in most computers. I remember people 10 years ago buying a CD burner for $600 or $700. You can now buy something that does DVD burning and writing, reading and writing, etc., for less than $50, probably less than $40. On a DVD-RW drive, or DVD-RW, can store around about 4.7 gigs of information. There's a newer form of DVD now called Blu-ray, and the reason it's called Blu-ray is because the light, or the laser that's used to read the information onto and off the CD, from the DVD, is actually blue in colour. It's a shorter wavelength of light, and therefore you can actually have a high density of peaks and valleys on the media, which means you can get more information. Whereas the older DVDs actually use a red laser or a lower frequency or longer wavelength light. Okay. Static memory and memory sticks. This goes on for a bit. We've done all this before. Static memory uses memory chips to store information. This information is retained after power is turned off. This is interesting. It's talking here about 128 megabytes of storage here. Good grief, I wouldn't touch anything unless it's 8 gigs, 16 gigs, etc. These devices have widely replaced floppy disks, so there you go, the curriculum's getting a bit old there, but we all go out and buy, well, Kim and I were buying memory cards the other week. I think really the one of the lowest ones we found were 4 gigs these days. Computers typically now have a mix of magnetic, optical, and static memory storage devices. Are there any questions? Okay, anyone can tell us, let's see, anyone's awake, what's a peripheral device?
Something that you connect to a to the computer, either by USB or FireWire, something that you plug into the computer.
Yep, it says here in the notes, the peripheral device is something you add to the computer to expand its capabilities. These devices are actually optional in nature and are not really that necessary for the basic functioning of the computer, so it's really an enhancement. And as Paul rightly said, peripheral devices, welcome along, Paul. Peripheral devices are connected externally through the computer using a specialized wireless or USB connection. They can really fit into one of four categories. That is input, output, storage, or networking devices. Example. So let's have some examples, folks, of common peripheral devices.
Printers.
Scanners.
Yep, I like those too.
Keyboards.
External hard drives.
Yep, keyboards and external hard drives. Yep. Anything else?
Printer. Speakers. Speakers.
Yep, speakers. And you'll get some of these questions, what's an input device, what's an output device in your various exams. Trackballs, digital cameras, and, sorry?
The mouse.
Yep, the mouse, exactly. And for vision impaired people, what's one of the most important gadgets?
Yours.
Keyboard.
Well, that's keyboard. That's the software end of it, though. JAWS would be a software end of it.
Oh, yeah, cool.
No. We're not talking about the keyboard. Well, we're not talking about the software. We're talking about peripheral devices. I always think of a scanner. If you want to scan your books in.
Yes, scanner, and I'm actually sitting in front of one right now that I purchased.
Oh, very good. Well done. Okay, we can have external modems and external network interface cards. There you go, as well. Okay, it talks about disk drives. Look, I'm not going to go on about this. We're probably going to run out of time. You got scanners, read your notes, guys, mouse, mice, flash drives. It's all peripherals. Network interface cards, an external network interface card. Well, I guess you could say my modem that I'm on with the redundant computers external, you have to plug it in through the USB. Printers, of course, you plug them into USB now. We used to plug them into parallel. And modems, etc. Modems we used to have as serial devices. Cases and power supplies. Now, we're going to do a lot on this in IT in the next 2 weeks over at Kylie's class. So for those of you who are in Grace's class, I'm not quite sure when she started. I think she's starting the same time as Kylie. In Chapter 1, we talk about the form factor. We need to make sure our case is the right size for the bits that we're going to put in it. Some cases are designed to sit on top of the user's desk, which is a true desktop computer. Others are designed to sit under the desk. Computers are designed to sit on the desk, provide easy access to drives and bits and pieces in it, whereas the one sitting under your desk, you've got to take the sides off and generally slide it out from under the desk. Whatever the case style or form factor, which is size and shape for the IT students, select a case that has enough space for all of the components you want to put in it. The power supply must be sufficient to supply the motherboard, the processor, and any devices. And I once knew somebody, I still know this person, but back in the 1990s, he was having trouble with a hard drive, or I think he was having trouble with a CD burner at the time, and it turned out the power supply just didn't quite have enough grunt to keep all this junk going. Okay, what else is here? Okay, we need the power supply because the power supplied by many electricity companies is subject to fluctuation, and we really don't want to jam 240 volts, or if you're in North America, 110 volts right in the front end of your motherboard because it will go bang. A poor power supply, as in the case of my friend Adrian, can cause the computer to malfunction. Okay. Now, I don't know what this is doing here. We talk about a surge suppressor here, and a lot of this goes on in IT2, Chapter 2. You can put a surge suppressor on your mains, and it is designed to remove voltage spikes and surges from the power line and prevent them from damaging the computer. These days, a surge suppressor is relatively inexpensive, and I think many of them come on now. Most power boards are power strips. Usually the surge suppressor is plugged in the power outlet, and you'll plug your computer into the surge suppressor. Some of these suppressors also have connections for the phone line to protect your computer and modem from voltage spikes and surges that can be carried through the telephone line. Now, an interesting thing that happened to me during the lightning strike here is the reason my Linksys integrated services router went bang was because of what Craig and I believe to be electromagnetic pulse caused by the lightning, as well as the potential difference and or possibly junk coming through the phone line, which cooked the integrated services router. It also took out, because it was connected via Ethernet, my main machine, and the damage to that was the damage to the network interface card on the motherboard and the sound, and that's what rendered that motherboard useless. Even though the computer did boot up, Windows just couldn't find a network or sound device. Oh, and it also took out the USB. It could have very easily have taken out my server and VoIPBox, which is also connected via Ethernet. So I've now since got that isolated with a protective filter on that phone line. So there you go. You can also get uninterruptible power supplies. Anyone know what they are?
Yes, they otherwise known as a UPS. It's a device that gives uninterruptible power in case of a storm or other emergencies.
That's it. And for really how long?
A couple of days.
No, absolutely not. Usually long enough.
Brief periods of time.
Well done, Kim. Brief periods of time. So you've got enough time to shut your computer down and save your work and get everything shut down in an orderly fashion. I'm fortunate enough here that I can run my server because it's a very, very light-powered server while I wait server off it for quite some time. I think I've timed it up to nearly half an hour. The main workstation would have to go. If the power went off now, I'd be saying, I'm on UPS, guys, I've got to go. Okay, it can actually keep the modem and router up for quite some time, this particular one here too, which is handy. So it depends on what you're running off it. It basically is a device that will continuously monitors the power and the computer system, if you've got the right software installed, and will allow you, it will automatically switch in its own battery supply if the mains goes off. It provides backup power, as Paul said, and really runs from battery inside the UPS, and as Kim rightly said, can only power the computer system for a short period of time. Okay. This also provides an even flow of power to the computer, and therefore can prevent damage to the computer or the software that's on the computer. It also protects you from voltage surges too. So I feel well protected. I've got surge suppressors, I've got the UPS on here and everything. So, you know, theoretically it's like you take all the precautions you can to minimise the risk of getting caught. Okay, questions while I scroll down. Anyone got questions before we move to 1.5? In 1.5, it just basically talks about here, computers are a collection of highly complex components working together in a harmonious way. okay, basically, if any computer functions fail, you may have to open the computer up and start working inside the case. Okay, when working inside a computer case, and we'll learn all this from IT Chapter 2, it is really a good idea to keep some things in mind. These things are really designed to prevent damage to the computer components. Before the computer case is open, make sure the computer is switched off and the power cable is unplugged. Yeah, right. Okay. How many times have I forgotten to do that? Or how many times have I had a computer running while I've had it apart? So, but in fairness to the Cisco curriculum, especially when, it depends on what you're doing, you don't want to be unplugging hard drives when the computer's powered up, but I have actually had a number of computers apart while I'm running the course, because I need to be working on it. But yeah, if you're going to go into a computer, especially depending on what you do, it's a wise idea to isolate it and also ground yourself. We'll be talking a lot about grounding and using wrist straps in ITE. Computer monitors and computer systems and monitors, but usually monitors, particularly in the cathode ray days, can be very heavy, and it's best to familiarise yourself with safe work practices before lifting them. Lift your monitors with caution. As my Uncle Ian found out the day he took home my old monitor I didn't want, didn't he, Nerissa?
Yes.
Yes, he didn't like lifting that, especially when we took it to Toastmasters that night. Before I gave it to you.
I forget that. It was quite heavy, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, hauling that bloody thing around, it was no joke. Fortunately, Alan was able to get it back out to the car for us because I had to lift it at one point, and that was hard. Before opening a computer system, be sure you make have a suitable work area. In other words, don't go pulling it to bits when you've got clutter all over the place. Preferably, make sure you've got a nice, clean, open environment, a place to put your screws when you pull it to bits. Your work area should be well organised and free of clutter. For the sighted folks, it should be adequately lit to prevent eye strain. Wear proper eye protection to prevent accumulated dust, screws and components causing damage to the eyes. Additionally, when opening a case, be aware that there are sharp edges that should be avoided. Okay, well, yeah, when you get really good with your dexterity. But yeah, be careful. Some of the cases have jagged edges in them. Beware. Woohoo. Power supplies and monitors, I repeat, power supplies and monitors operate at high voltages and should only be opened by individuals with specialised training. So even though you might think you're a good enough hack to rip a hard drive out of a computer, unless you've been properly trained, please avoid pulling monitors to bits, cathode ray monitors particularly, and power supplies. I know people who do it, who are clever, but that's not really for everybody to do. Okay. Some computer systems are specially designed to enable components to be hot swapped. A hot swappable device means you can actually plug it in and unplug it while the computer is running. So in other words, when you're swapping in and out these components, it allows the system to remain running. A mouse, a USB mouse, for example, is a good idea. You can hot swap those. Unless you're sure that the system is hot swappable, turn it off before opening. I'm led to believe SATA drives are hot swappable. I've never really tried it. I don't really want to find it the hard way. Okay, internal. And this is for people living in dry environments, especially like in Arizona for Jackie, and actually Ontario where it's winter and it's very dry. This next bit's important. Internal system components are especially prone to ESD, or electrostatic discharge. Now, electrostatic discharges can occur when the environment is dry. It's less likely to occur when it's humid. And I'm sure most of us here, and it happened to me when I was in Arizona, you brush against a car or you go to open a car door, or you brush against another person, you can feel a static, you tick. I think Kim was saying the other day, she got, would you get a bite off something the other day, didn't you?
Yeah, I can get nasty shocks out of, I don't know, I can touch the faucet, I can touch the computer, anything. It doesn't always happen, but it does.
So when we're pulling computers apart, we really want to ground ourselves off. If you don't have a wrist strap, you can put your hand, I usually rest my hand against the case, because if you get anything more than a 3,000 volt shock, that's when you start to feel it. Believe it or not, I think it's in the IT test, 3,000 volts, if I remember rightly, that you can actually feel. No current, so you're not going to die, but that sort of voltage can render a computer component useless. So there you go. Electrostatic discharge, static electricity that can be transferred from your body to electronic components in the computer. And it basically just reiterates what I just told you. It will make your computer components go bang if it gets it. Where are we going with the notes? basically says here in the notes, and I do encourage you to read it, electrostatic discharge can occur when two objects are at different potentials and are connected through a conductor, a la U, and allows electrons to flow between them. The electrons flowing between the two objects will be an attempt to balance out the charge. Okay, have a look at the notes, because it also uses a water analogy, and we all just love learning about the water analogy in science when studying electrical stuff. Okay, basically it goes on here to talk about a safety checklist. Use an anti-static mat and wrist strap. Use an anti-static bag to store and move computer components, those little plastic bags that look like they're actually made of metal, that you find that you get your RAM in when you buy it from the shop, so you get your hard disks in. Don't put any more than one component in a bag, because stacking them could cause similar, like electrostatic build-up charges between them. It could also cause components to break or become loose. There's always a little bit of circuit board on the bottom end of a hard drive. Okay, I've talked about ground yourself by touching a piece of metal on the chassis. That's fine. Any questions before we move on to installing? This is really like a real rehash of IT, isn't it? Okay. Following procedures apply to most system components. God, this is hard when you've got to do it on your own for 2 hours. Jeez. Okay.
It's very hard.
Yeah, I know. Missing Jay. Jay, come back. All is forgiven. Okay. Determine if the computer component is hot-swappable. If you're in doubt, unplug the computer and isolate it from the power so you don't make anything go bang. Two, attach a grounding strap from your body to the chassis of the computer to prevent any damage that could be caused by ESD. Three, if replacing a component, remove the old component and basically throw it out. No, put it somewhere that's not going to get mixed up with the right component. They can be held in by screws. When removing screws, do not let screws drop on the system motherboard. So basically, you don't really want screws, and it's happened to me, pulling bits out, bloody screws, you drop the screw and you end up having to get the computer and hold it upside down and hope for the best it drops on the floor, that sort of stuff. Be careful not to break any plastic clips. Check the connection type on the new component, like you've got different cards, make sure the card will go. I gave my graphics card out of Firebolt to Amy the other week, Nerissa, only to have Amy ring up and go, "Oh, it's not the right type of card." Yeah, good on you. Now I've either got to get the card back or just let it go.
Damn.
So basically, stick it where it fits, basically. If it won't plug in, don't force it, really. And that goes to IDE hard drives, power connectors. It goes with anything of this ilk, when putting expansion cards in. If it don't go in, don't force it. Either because you've got some obstruction in the way or you are trying to fit the wrong card in the wrong slot.
I have something to say. I've noticed people when they're hooking up stuff for me that they'd plug the USB into the Ethernet port and it doesn't go there.
That's it. Well, don't do it. Yeah, even if you're just connecting a computer up to a network and you haven't got it to bits, make sure you're plugging the right things in the right holes, pretty much. Again, don't force it because you could damage one of the jacks. Okay, and it goes into a little bit of troubleshooting here. For example, if you put in a component like another graphics card, I fitted a graphics card to my friend Jillian's computer in August and it didn't go. So I had to do some troubleshooting. I had to take the card back out, fire up the computer and determine whether the computer was still going to go. It did. It was more of an electronic problem. It could have been caused by the motherboard not wanting to talk to that card, even despite the fact I had all the BIOS things right, etc. Same thing can happen with hard drives. I've been known to fit hard drives in a computer and found that particularly back in the IDE days, we've had the jumper settings wrong, and we've had to turn the computer on, and if it won't go, then either take the hard drive out and reset the jumpers, etc. So it is common sense. If you put a component in the computer and it doesn't go, or if you put several components in the computer and it doesn't go, you have to sort of start taking them out until it goes again. Make sure your hardware and software is compatible, it says here. You can have problems with Windows or with the driver. If you put in a new graphics card, for example, the first thing Windows is going to do is go to find new hardware and want the graphics driver for the new graphics card, for example. We'll do a lot of this in ITE. Okay, Windows, or most operating systems, if it does discover a new piece of hardware added to the machine, it will prompt you to insert the driver disk or to install the driver. As well, drivers are continuously updated to improve efficiency and functionality. Narissa struck this in a worksheet the other day. I think she had to install a specific printer driver and was checking for a possible functionality update, which I think you said, Narissa, the tabs look the same anyway. Were they not in the printer driver? That's all right. Windowing worksheet, guys, and Narissa found this the other day because she's off the mark and running, is that if you find that a worksheet says, notice the difference in the tabs if you've installed a driver and you go into the properties of the printer driver and you hunt around, if you're doing anything, and you don't notice a change, that's fine. Own up and simply say, I report no changes. The worksheet may not know about that particular printer driver that Narissa installed, so that may look the same as the previous printer driver is what I'm trying to say. So if you can't see any changes, just say you can't see any changes. All the worksheets are designed to do is, or the labs, they're used interchangeably, those two terms, is to demonstrate to us, the instructors, that you know what you're doing. So if you don't see the changes that it may have in the suggested in the lab or the worksheet, don't stress. Most updated drivers can be obtained from the vendor's websites. Always read any documentation that accompanies the device. Once installed, the component should be tested for complete functionality. You really don't want to be doing this for a client or a customer and have the client or customer ring you up a day later and go, yeah, it still can't print. And then you've got to go back at your expense to fix it. Okay. Oh, look, it's all this troubleshooting stuff. We haven't got much time, but if it fails to function properly, it just tells us to check the connections. Basic troubleshooting first. If you install a printer driver and you can't print, make sure the printer is physically connected to the machine, make sure it's powered on and online, and just go through the troubleshooting steps. If you determine the device is defective, then you should return it to the vendor, and we often call it a DOA. Oh, look, installing peripherals and verifying operation, this is all basic stuff. We talk about USB devices here. Peripheral components, unlike their internal counterparts, do not require the computer case to be open. We just plug it in, and as Paul was saying, somebody was trying to plug some USB stuff into the Ethernet. Originally, printers were designed to connect to a parallel port. That means the computer would transfer data from itself to the printer in a particular format. More recently, the development of the universal serial bus, or some people used to say the useless serial bus, has greatly simplified the connection. And it has. It's pretty reliable. When USB first came out in the late 1990s, it was a bit of a hit and miss affair. But now it's pretty good, and you generally get a USB device, and Windows goes found new hardware, and you're up and running. Generally, they're easy to configure. You may be also needing to put in the proper driver, of course. Okay, now the peripheral devices often require several steps, and that is connecting the device, installing any necessary software or drivers that come with it. Now, we'll point out a bit of a gotcha here. Some devices have a quick start guide or a note that says, please install driver first. And it's wise to be aware of that before you just go, oh, beauty, I got my printer, it's out of the box, let's just plug it in and turn it all on, away she'll go, because bang, Windows will try and plug and pray it, and you'll end up having all sorts of grief trying to get the thing uninstalled, etc. So do check the vendor's instructions when it comes to whether I should install my software first, then plug in my device, or whether I should plug in my device, then install the software. It usually tells you. So it does tell you the order of these steps will vary depending on the physical connection and depending on whether the peripheral is a plug-and-play device, etc. I'm going to skip some of this because we're all doing, most of us are doing IT, and those who aren't have probably done IT-like things anyway. A lot of printers will offer a testing functionality. Be familiar with it. A good way for vision impaired people is if you can get hold of the book in PDF format of the printer or any device that, that you wish to buy before you purchase it, get the book down. Have a look. Craig, my friend Craig does that. He won't buy anything unless he's read the book first. If you have a printer that doesn't seem to work, you might want to swap your cable for a known good cable. It's often good, especially when you've got as much junk around your place as I have, to have extra cables around, so that if something doesn't print, or if you do plug your computer into a router or a modem or something and it won't talk, swap out the cable because it could be the cable that's defective and you can be up and running. Hello, Kylie.
Hello, I hope you're all having fun. I meant pop in earlier, but people needed my help, so it's great to be here.
Yes, we saw you there. Hi, Kylie. We saw you pop in and you went away again.
Yes, I was just showing a student how to navigate Ventrilo. Sorry about that.
We thought so. We knew it wasn't really you didn't like us. We knew you were doing that. Okay. Oh, guess what, folks? We're at the chapter quiz and we have 10 minutes to go. So before we get to the chapter quiz, are there any questions?
Well, I have a question. Regarding a printer that I have that's connected with an all-in-one, and it basically, I can't get it to print and configure the port for the printer.
All right, well, you'll have to talk to us off-channel about that, but it will be something like, well, firstly, does it scan or does it do the other functions? That's the first part of this troubleshooting step. If you can't configure it or if you can't talk to it, will the other functionality, the other functionalities work on that printer?
Yes, the other functions do, but the printer itself won't work because it's trying to configure
a port.
What
are the other functions, Paul?
The scanner works, the copier, scan to PDF, copy utility, and fax monitor port work, but the printer doesn't.
So when you say the scanner works, you can get a document and have it put on your computer and see it in your application like your word processor or a graphics program?
Yes, basically. But when I try to print...
When you try and print, okay. Mm-hmm. So obviously you've got a physical connection between your computer and the device, which is good. It's a bit of a general question because I can't see your printer driver. One of the things I might suggest you do is uninstall and reinstall it and go through its advanced options and check for port settings. Also, make sure that the printer is online. You may all want to check, it's something we haven't had to do for a while, to make sure that the printer port is set up properly in the device manager and that it's EPS or EECP, whatever it needs to be. So it's a little bit of a troubleshooting step that we can't really fix in this class, but I would certainly suggest that check those attributes. We don't check for ECP, it's universal serial bus, so it's...
Yeah,
I would
USB.
Check in the device manager to make sure. Yeah, bit of a fiddle job to troubleshoot in this class, but at least you're on the right track. You've done your troubleshooting. You've decided that the printer, that the scanner works. Check to see if get a sighted person to see if there's an online or offline light displaying. That's another step. Also check to see if there's enough ink in it.
Okay. Well, I will do that. Thanks for your tips there, Elise.
That's okay. And also, take a note of any error messages. It might be telling you that it's out of ink. A lot of these newer printers these days have a counter, and they can measure the ink, but they usually have a counter, and if they think they're out of ink, even if you've replaced the ink cartridges, if you haven't reset the counter, it'll say, no, I'm out of ink, I'm not going to print.
So you got to reset everything. It's just basically a troubleshooting thing.
Yeah, and some of these printers have got little LCD displays on them now, and they'll be saying, have you inserted an ink cartridge? Press plus for yes and minus for no. I think actually mine's minus for yes and plus for no. And then it will ask you, have you replaced the black cartridge? And again, you press the appropriate button for yes or no, and you... get the same thing, the colour, and then it will go, cool, you've replaced it. So if you can get a site link to read you those prompts. Just answer yes in both cases and it will reset its counter and you may be able to print. They're basic troubleshooting steps that we can offer, and that's about all we can offer. Has anyone else got questions?
Just one other thing that it might be is the print spooler is hung. There's something wrong with the print spooler, because I think he said he could copy, which means the printer, the actual device is working.
Yeah, good point. I did forget that. So you can copy and print out on pieces of paper what you've copied, Paul?
Yeah, I can scan, but I can use the copier. The Epson copy utility works. And by the way, I got this. It says that it works with Windows 7, but when I looked at the documentation, it only says Windows Vista. I updated the driver, and it still doesn't work.
Well, we won't get into troubleshooting Paul's printer here because it's not the forum in which to do it. But yeah, I would have. I think Marshall offered some very good advice. Check the print spool. Delete anything. There's also a print service that I think Jackie stopped on one of our, not my machine, but one of the students' machines and restarted it. That can sometimes hang. So I won't really go into too much here because if I suggest something, you go and try it and it breaks, we'll be in bigger trouble. But they're the sorts of things I would look at. We really have to move on to the quiz. Are there any other questions or comments? All right. Okay, folks, now this is going to be interesting for me. Everyone needs their chat window open. For who hasn't got it open? Let's have a look. Everyone has their chat windows open. This is good. Now, if we can all alt-tab to our chat windows and focus there. What's going to happen? This is the chapter quiz. We won't do it every week if we're running out of time, but suffice it to say, we will do it as often as we can. What I'm going to ask you to do is to type in a letter corresponding to what you believe the right answer to be. I'll ask you a question with four possible answers. I'll make a statement with four possible answers. It'll be a little bit like what you get in the tests. Okay, a company requires a high-end computer that can store a significant amount of data. And it can. It also needs to process files and applications quickly. Which two components are the most critical for the computer's performance? Okay, I'll give you the components. Option A is RAM. Option B is CPU. Option C is the video card. Option D is the sound card. And option E is the modem. Go now. It's hard doing it myself. Well, we have four answers, and everyone who got A and B, which is everybody out there, are correct. Well done. Which peripheral is a storage device that connects the USB interface and allows files to be saved and moved between computers? Option A. A, a modem. B, a scanner. C, a printer. D, a flash drive. And E, a network interface card. Go now. Okay, for everyone who got D, you are correct. It's different doing this on your own. I usually like giving the credits and getting Jackie to give these quizzes. We give the credits verbally because the TTS doesn't come out on the recordings. Which computer provides backup power to a computer system for a short period of time? A, CPU. B, modem. C, surge suppressor. Or D, uninterruptible power supply. Go now. What is that? Yep, everyone answering D, you are correct. Uninterruptible power supply. Boy, does this sound different using Anna. It could be worse, could be Sam. All right. Which term describes static electricity which could be transferred from your body to the electronic components in a computer? Option A, voltage surge. Option B, voltage spike. Option C, grounding. Option D, surge suppressor. Option E, electrostatic discharge. Go now. Everybody answering E, and that's everyone, 100%, are correct, which is electrostatic discharge. What are two examples of input-only devices? Choose two. Option A, printer. Option B, a scanner. Option C, a joystick. Option D, a flash drive. Option E, an external network interface card. And option F, a monitor. Go now.
Can you repeat the choices again?
Yep, for an input-only device. Printer, scanner, joystick, flash drive, external monitor. So they are A for printer, B for scanner. Hang on, input-only device, did we say? Hang on. Yes. Yeah, okay. Input-only devices. Option A is a printer. Option B is a scanner. Option C is a joystick. Option D is a flash drive. Option E is an external NIC. And option F is a monitor. Okay, people offering B and C, you are correct, which is the scanner and the joystick.
I didn't know joysticks were input. I'm sorry.
That's all right. That's what we're here to do. We're here to learn. They're input devices because a movement on a joystick will cause something to happen, like movement inside the computer. A small real estate company wants to purchase a computer used for file storage. This is actually important. A small real estate company with only one office wants to purchase a computer to use for file storage. Here we go. Option A, a mainframe server. Option B, a standalone server. Option C, a rack mount server. Option D, a workstation. Or option E, a blade server. Go now. Okay, any other questions? Yep, we're getting them in. Okay, everyone answering option B, you are correct. It is a standalone server. Okay, a user opens an application and sends a message to a person in another country. What type of application has been used? A, a local application. B, a graphics application. C, a network application. Or D, a standalone application. Everyone answering C, 100%, you're all correct. The last two questions. Oh, here we go. I'm going to skip two out of the last three questions because we're now over time and they are too hard to read, so I'll give you question 9 only. Okay, what measurement is commonly associated with graphics resolution? Option A, hertz, or HZ. Option B, megabytes, MB. Option C, gigabytes, or GB. Option D is BPS. And option E is pixels. Go now. Everyone answering E for pixels, you are correct. Well done, folks. We are at the end of the lecture. Are there any questions? Have we all survived? Oh, silence is the stern reply. That's a worry.
Well, considering I joined late, I think I got everything I needed.
Great. Well, I will...
Not quite dead yet.
Not quite dead yet. Good, thanks, Kim. And you've joined us late. That's good, Paul. You're welcome back.
Just in intensive care.
And the rest is in intensive care. Well done. There you go. Well, I suggest you all read your notes. I'll put the exams up later anyway, but they are available for 1 week and they will continuously be put up anyway, so even if you don't get to it over the next week. And particularly read that formula I was telling you about of dividing the file size with the network bandwidth and that sort of stuff. I'll probably go over that again next week, I think.
Elise, I have a question regarding accessing the curriculum.
Yes.
For the flash, what do I need to select to be able to access the curriculum?
Okay, well, look, I can send you the Word files. I'll send you the Word documents. Paul, send me an email to remind me, and I'll send you the Word documents, because the Flash, I'm not familiar with it. I refuse to have anything to do with it. And as far as I'm concerned, everyone should have access to the written material in a Word or RTF format. So I wouldn't know. I don't want to know about it. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. Flash should not be used in the teaching environment with visually impaired people, and that's that.
I agree with you, Elise.
Paul, can I just say I use Zoom text, and I tried to look at the flash version and it was impossible for me to see properly, so I certainly wouldn't recommend it.
No, there's a school of thought that argues that we should have to, you know, be accessible. We live in a sighted world, and we shouldn't, you know, pirate the curriculum. But hey, you know, we're an accessible organisation. We are an organisation that spruiks how good we are because we can make our courses accessible for people. So that therefore must carry through to accessibility of all materials, and this is a vital part of your learning materials. So I will make it available, and I will make no apologies for doing so.
Thank you, Elise. I will be emailing you shortly.
I'll put a Dropbox up. Yeah, Elise@lonsdalemedia.com.au or Elise@lonsdalemedia.org. Either will work and come through here. Yeah. But I think everyone's done well and you've all participated well, and thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. It's been a joy sitting here.
Thanks, Elise.
Thanks, Elise. Have a good.
You're welcome, Pat. Yeah, we all welcome Narissa. You're welcome, Marshall.
Thanks, Elise.
It was great to have Pat along from the other class. Thanks, Kim. It's always good to have everyone here. And great that you could drop in too, Kylie.
Well, I'm sorry it couldn't be earlier. It brings back some good memories.
It does. Kylie's really whiz when it comes to Discovery One. She got there in record time, didn't you? But that doesn't say everybody else has to. It's just that she was really into it. So it's a good course, and I'm sure you'll all enjoy it. Okay, check you all later.